With the Carolina Panthers facing off against the Denver Broncos in Super Bowl 50, football is on our minds this week. For millions of fans, kicking back every Sunday to cheer or cry while your favorite teams compete is a happy weekly ritual, just part of the good life. But for English professor Mark Edmondson, the football field is a staging ground for some of life's most important lessons. In his book, Why Football Matters, Edmondson looks back on the years he played the game in high school and reflects on how it taught him courage, resilience, determination, and lots of other values. He talked with Raymond Tungekar about why football continues to inspire him.
Well, my first introduction to the game was watching it with my dad. And my dad was like a 50s dad who, you know, had the cigarettes, had the beer. And he was also kind of a hyperactive dad. He was a restaurant cook and he didn't stay still much so I could talk to him or hang with him. But there was an exception, and that was when the New York Football Giants came on. Then he would sit down, glued to the TV set, some commentary. But there he was, and I could do something with him, and that was to watch the Giants.
And so you grew up kind of venerating this game. And then eventually, in high school, you decided to actually try out for the team. And it's worth pointing out that growing up, you weren't really athletic, you had asthma, you had poor eyesight. So what compelled you to sign up?
I had a tremendous amount going for me, didn't I? I had always enjoyed playing in the park. I liked the guys who played on the team. I knew some of them. And the game had fascinated me from the time that I was a boy. And I think that when I watched those great players, I had probably formed the resolution that someday down the line I would try to play myself. I didn't know what the standard was for making the team, and it turned out that it was sheer attrition. We started out with about 125 guys, and they dropped like flies. And so there was no cutting on the team, per se, lucky for me, or else I would have been gone. But I would say 60 or 70 of the guys who looked to me ferociously tough guys, gang guys, some of them South Medford Bears, some of them, they quit the team, and lo and behold, I was able to stay around.
And each chapter in your book reads kind of like this miniature lesson plan where you detail a specific virtue that you learned from the sport. And, you know, early on in the book, you write about courage. So how did football train you to be more courageous?
Well, the whole courage thing is a little bit more complicated than I would have imagined. I thought that there are people who just were courageous and could draw upon courage. And that clearly wasn't me. So in order to do the things that it purportedly took guts to do, I had to take a different route. And the route that I took was a little distressing when you look back on it. I would remember, just before I was going to have to run into somebody, I would remember something that had really humiliated me or made me angry. And I would bring that thought to mind, and I would become enraged by it, or at least pretty distressed by it. And that would allow me to go slamming into other people. Eventually, this is a strange kind of therapy, I guess. Eventually, I didn't need the thoughts anymore, and I was happy to slam into other people. It didn't hurt nearly as much as I thought it would, number one. And number two, it hurt a heck of a lot less when you were the slammer rather than the slammy.
Well, another lesson that you describe has to do with coping with loss, which seems, you know, pretty obvious. Of course, football will teach you that. But your experience actually gave you a unique, more nuanced insight into different kinds of loss.
Well, yes. One of the lines that I'm proudest of in the book, looking back, is the line that says, "Games matter so much because they don't matter much at all." And that is, you get to act out within the theater of different kinds of sports, feelings and aspirations and forms of discipline and forms of connection with other people that are symbolic and displaced rather than actual. I was surprised how much it hurt to lose a football game, even one that I barely played in. Tears and sorrow and grief and lamentation, right? But it was a rehearsal for other forms of loss that take place in life. Now, it happened that I had had a very serious and deep form of loss not too much before I started playing football. We had lost my sister Barbara Ann. You know, there was, I saw similarities between those two states of loss. There was one of them that was mortal and horrible and irreversible, and another one that was theatrical and provisional and play-acted in a certain sense, but it taught you something nonetheless.
Do you recall like a moment in which, you know, these lessons that you learned from football helped you cope with the loss of your sister, Barbara Ann?
You know, the more stuff you lose, the better you get at it. But I do think that you can acquire some kind of intuitive knowledge about the dynamics of loss. There's a great essay, which I mentioned in my book by Sigmund Freud, called Mourning and Melancholia, about the dynamics of loss. And he says a lot about it, and it's an astonishingly brilliant essay. But one of the main things he says about it is, if you're reasonably sane, there's nothing you have to do. The work of mourning will take place on its own. It has a certain kind of trajectory, and if you're patient, it will come to an end, right? But when it does come to an end, you've got to learn how to take up and go back to work and go back to your life again. You cannot stay there in a prolonged way. And that was something my coaches taught me, and it was something that my mother also taught me in her reaction to my sister's death.
Well, there's one game in particular that you write about that I found so heartbreaking. It's this game. I forgot who the other team was, but you describe this terrific loss and the bus ride back. It's just you and all your teammates on this bus sniffling and crying.
Yes. I had never experienced this before. All these big, tough guys are crying and moaning and weeping and bewailing themselves. It sounded like, you know, the women at the fall of Troy or something. And the coach let us nurse it for a while, but then he said, you know, he respected it and he understood it. But then he put us back to work and said, this is coming to an end now, fellas. No more of this sort of stuff. And we responded to him. He was good.
Well, so by now, it should be pretty clear that, you know, you're kind of ambivalent when it comes to football. I mean, you clearly have a soft spot for the sport, but you realize that, you know, it can have kind of a dark side.
Oh, it's definitely got a dark side, but I am a big fan of football as a form of education for certain kinds of young people, right? I mean, it's a place that you can learn cohesion with a group, you can learn following other people, you can learn toughness, you can learn spiritedness, you can learn how to lose. All those things are great.
Well, your son for a while also played football, right?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He was a terrific player. He was this little tiny guy and he was ferocious and he ran down the quarterbacks and he ran down the halfbacks and they called him Pitbull. And I always knew that you weren't supposed to kind of gain satisfaction for your own inadequacies as a child through the activities of your child. But I thought this was perfect. I could do this just once and it would be all right. And at a certain point, it became clear to me, as it became clear to Matthew, he didn't really like football that much. He was playing because, like me, he had a lot of things that he was mad at. And when he left the game, he was happy to leave. Hmm. And I was happy for him to leave.
So did football also for him have the same effect that it did for you? That it was kind of this, it was kind of like a spiritual balm for you in a way, right?
It was. My son played when he was much younger. You know, he's 7, 8, 9 years old. I think he just had a good time. He was good at it. He had some frustrations, more than a few. This gave him a vehicle to act out those frustrations in a way that got him lots of applause. I mean, Howie Long, one of the greatest football players who ever lived, was an admirer of my son's game for a while.
Wait, really? Howie Long?
Howie Long,
how did that come out?
Well, Howie lives in Charlottesville and is, you know, a kindly, civic-minded fellow. And he had a son on the team and he used to come to practice and come to games, and he was very generous with his presence and with his praise for the kids. And, you know, I just picked out Matthew a couple of times as a real dynamite player. And I love that. Matthew loved that.
Okay. Well, I don't think we can avoid talking about some of the criticisms, especially, you know, players' health and well-being. So you acknowledge that football could provide an education, but there are clear downsides for the people, for the players involved. I mean, do you feel some kind of moral ambivalence watching the sport, at least at the professional level?
No, I don't. The men who are playing that game have made a choice to play that game. It's a beautiful game, lively game, exciting game. They make a tremendous amount of money. They have a blast. There are people, and there have always been from the time that history began, who decide that they're going to throw everything they have into their youths, and middle age and old age may not be quite so wonderful. And now we have the information to put on the table in front of people and say, here are the risks you're taking. Do you still want to go? And the answer in many cases is, yes, indeed, I do. If you start to think about the professions that are dangerous, well, you'd have to get rid of race car drivers. You'd have to get rid of rock and roll stars. You'd have to get rid of abstract expressionist artists. All of them have high expectations of disaster in their lives. People choose to risk themselves. People choose to risk themselves. It may be that society will arrive at a consensus that this is too violent a sport, but already the sport is trying to contain its more violent aspects with what I think is mixed success.
Well, I mean, given the risks, especially with younger players, especially given the fact that concussions are far worse with children, do you feel some kind of moral ambivalence about children playing this sport, or do you think that the education value outweighs the risks?
At this point, I think that you want to wait until your child is in 8th or 9th grade. You want to make sure that the helmets are good helmets. You want to make sure that the coach teaches you how to tackle with your shoulders. You want to make sure that there are strong rules against head-to-head collisions and that they are enforced. And then if you have a certain sort of son, or in a couple of cases, daughters, I think you give them the green light. I mean, most concussions for young people come from riding bicycles. It's not proportional to the number of concussions that you get playing football, but that's where most concussions come from. You get as many concussions from college soccer as you do college football, but there are many more subconcussive events for college football. There's no doubt about that. It's a dangerous game, but most things that have value are in some measure dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Do you miss playing the game?
Oh, yeah. Everybody does. Everybody who had a good experience playing the game misses playing the game. And you'll have to go a long way before you find somebody who says, I regret playing that game, even if they're limping as they're walking towards you to tell you the news.
Hmm. Mark, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for the good questions.
That's Mark Edmondson and Raymond Tungekar. Mark is the author of Why Football Matters, My Education in the Game.